This is the TriDot Podcast. TriDot uses your training data and genetic profile combined with predictive analytics and artificial intelligence to optimize your training, giving you better results in less time with fewer injuries. Our podcast is here to educate, inspire, and entertain. We'll talk all things triathlon with expert coaches and special guests. Join the conversation and let's improve together.
October is here, fall is in the air, and Kona season is upon us. Listen, friends, I know Kona has been rescheduled this year, and actually at the time this podcast releases, the World Championships should have just happened. And yeah, it's a bummer that it couldn't go forward here in 2020, but even without a fresh Kona race day to watch and talk about, you know, there are plenty of amazing Kona storylines for us to enjoy hearing about. And I think that can even somewhat maybe fill the void in our triathlete souls that is missing the race this particular year. So today we have a special guest joining us for a TriDot Podcast Kona edition that we are calling The Legends of Kona. We'll be taking a look back at the dynasties, rivalries, and champions that have made Kona the legendary race that we come back to watch year after year. Leading us in this look back is a legend of Kona himself, Kurt Madden. Kurt is a pioneer of the sport and a 9-time Kona finisher. He has 3 top 10 finishes at the Ironman World Championships, and he is a 3-time ranked age group Ironman All-World athlete. And as if 140.6 miles isn't quite enough, he is also a 2-time Ultraman World Champion, and in 2019 was inducted into the Ultraman World Championships Hall of Fame. Kurt is an Ironman certified, USAT certified, and TriDot coach based in San Diego, California. So, Kurt, thanks for just kind of coming on the TriDot podcast and taking some time to talk about Kona.
Andrew, thank you for this opportunity. I'm looking forward to telling a few stories.
Also joining us today is Coach John Mayfield. John is a USAT Level 2 and Ironman U certified coach who leads TriDot's athlete services, ambassador, and coaching programs. He has coached hundreds of athletes ranging from first-timers to Kona qualifiers and professional triathletes. John has been using TriDot since 2010 and coaching with TriDot since 2012. What's up, John?
So I have a great saying that it's a privilege to count your heroes among your friends. Mm. And I will absolutely say that Kurt is both a hero and a friend. So it's always great to spend some time with Kurt.
Well, I'm Andrew, the average triathlete, voice of the people, and captain of the middle of the pack. As always, we'll roll through our warm-up question, settle in for our Legends of Kona main set conversation, and then wind things down with our cool down. Lots of good stuff. Let's get to it.
Time to warm up. Let's get moving.
Every good race offers some sort of finish line and participant swag, and a staple of race day swag is the official race t-shirt. Some are given at the finish line to commemorate your conquering of the course, some are given at packet pickup, and some are for sale at the pre-race expo. It doesn't take very long for athletes to rack up a solid collection of race t-shirts, and Kurt, John, as much as the two of you have raced, I know you both could fill a closet with race day t-shirts. So from all the race shirts you have just received or purchased over the years, which one is just your go-to all-time favorite? And Kurt, first time on the podcast, let's start with you on this one.
Boy, Andrew, that's a very tough question to answer. I think you must actually be in my closet right now as I'm in my office in my fitness studio and I walk across here. You know, through the years, I've had a chance to really, I think each t-shirt has a memory. There's always a story behind the t-shirt. Many times my wife shares with me that I wonder how much that t-shirt is actually worth, the amount of time, the energy, the resources you spent in wearing that. But I think in the world of Ironman that when you actually get a t-shirt, you definitely have to complete the race. And that's the carrot that's always out there. And as I've, you know, reflected on the t-shirts that I've had through the years, it's a tough question, but I think if I had to really pinpoint, I'd have to go back to the t-shirt we received after the 1980 Ironman that was held on the island of Oahu. And back then it was called the Nautilus Triathlon. And it was a navy blue shirt, kind of like the way it is right now with the Ironman World Championship. It had the Nautilus symbol, and that was kind of a piece of training and exercise equipment that was very popular. But back in the day, that was the organization that sponsored the Ironman. And it simply had a 2.4-mile swim, 112-mile bike, and a 26.2 marathon. And I remember getting that back in the day that there were only 99 t-shirts that were given out in the entire world. So couldn't buy it online. You couldn't go down to you know, your local store and pick it up. But wearing that t-shirt with pride, knowing that it was very, very unique. And I think I probably wore that t-shirt for a good 5 or 6 years, especially when I was a graduate teaching assistant at San Diego State. And I don't know, it just, it gave me, I think, a certain distinction. At the same time, lo and behold, as my kids grew up, that t-shirt somehow was found. And my older son wore it till it was almost threads. And then my younger son wore it till there was just nothing left. And I think for me, that's something that I will always, always cherish.
So I was thinking, like, I think all triathletes would agree that that actually, like, belongs in the Smithsonian, but I guess it belongs to the ages now, huh?
Yeah, I'll go ahead and say mine, because mine is I mean, kind of like you said, Kurt. I mean, every t-shirt has a story, and you know, I haven't done my first Ironman yet, you know, still working towards that, you know, so I have, you know, the local tri down the road race t-shirts and a couple half Ironman t-shirts, and my favorite shirt is the t-shirt I bought from Ironman Village at my first 70.3. It was 70.3 New Zealand. You know, so it, for me, it was my first time like experiencing Ironman Village, experiencing that level of a race course and distance and just the event. And, you know, we're at Ironman Village and, you know, my wife, while I was on the race course, she knew that I had been looking in the tent at that was the first year they put out the shirts that had all the participants' names on the back. And so while I was out on the course, she went and picked up that shirt for me. And it's just, it's a nice shade of blue. You know, it's got all the participants' name on the back. And now they do that all at all the races, which is such a cool token, right, to really customize that shirt for that year. And it's got the Kellogg, you know, sponsored. Kellogg Cereal was a sponsor, and their little logo's on the top, and it says Ironman New Zealand 70.3. And I don't know, that shirt, it's just comfy. It's cozy. It fits me perfectly. And it's just a great memoir of my first kind of event of that magnitude. And I've gotten several since then, and that's always the one that, you know, as I'm throwing on a race day t-shirt to go somewhere, that's the first one I grab every single time. So, John, how about you? Which one is it for you?
So mine is a little different story. Mine's not that sentimental, great story like y'all's. mine is from the 2011 Ironman Texas 70.3, which is kind of my home race. That race is on Galveston Island, which is about 30 miles from my house. I think it was maybe the next year I was back at the race, and I found it on the clearance rack. So I think I paid like $12 for this shirt. One of the reasons I liked it, in fact, I wore it just like 2 or 3 days ago, and I've had it since, like, I guess 2012, is it doesn't necessarily look like your typical triathlete shirt. It's actually just like kind of a beach scene. It has like a lifeguard stand, and it says Galveston, Texas, and there's a little Ironman logo on it. So it's kind of like one of those covert things, like where
you definitely know that logo to know it was a race
day shirt. I can wear
it
out in public and people just think I just went to Galveston, but the triathletes out there, they'll know. So yeah, it's just a good shirt, and I love a good deal. So it was like $12, and I've been wearing it for all these years.
Well, guys, we're going to throw this question out to our athletes on social media, because I know you guys have some shirts. And honestly, I want to see pictures on this one, John. We're going to throw out on Facebook and Instagram, you know, the I Am Tryout Facebook group, Tryout Triathlon Training on Instagram. And we're going to put out a race day t-shirt picture post. And I kind of want some pictures from you guys. You know, what is that shot of you in that race day shirt that you're the most proud of, the one that you go to the front of your closet to grab and wear it out and around town? You know, we're going to throw this out to you guys, and let's move into the main set.
On to the main set. Going in 3, 2, 1.
Our main set today is brought to you by our friends at Garmin. In the fitness and multi-sport market, Garmin products are the gold standard, known for their compelling design, superior quality, and best value. As a triathlete, Garmin can be and should be your very best friend. They offer best-in-class GPS watches that can track your every swim, bike, and run with ease. When you are out on the bike, Garmin's Vector Power Pedals can measure those all-important watts, while their Edge cycling computers conveniently display all your data in real time as you ride. You can also bring Garmin into your pain cave with their Tacx indoor trainers and accessories. I tell everyone who will listen that my Tacx Flux indoor smart trainer is the best investment I have made in my own triathlon training. The best part is Garmin is fully integrated with TriDot, so your Garmin Connect and Garmin Health data seamlessly streams to TriDot and your training is continually optimized. So head to Garmin.com and check out all the cool tech they have to offer. The first time I watched the live coverage of the Ironman World Championships in Kona, I was just transfixed all day long as I watched Lucy Charles Barclay outswim the world, Daniela Reif dominate the field, and Patrick Longo run down a gimpy Lionel Sanders to make the winning pass with less than 5 kilometers to go. Kona is the most talked about race on the triathlon calendar each and every year, and it produces new storylines and new legends with each iteration of the race. And today we're going to revisit some of the most notable kind of Kona stories from the pro field, you know, with a man who has been there time and time again. So Kurt, let me start with this. Do you ever get tired of talking about Kona?
I would have to say I truly do not. And I think because as that topic comes up about triathlons and then they start talking about Ironman races, everyone wants to know about Kona. There's a certain mystique, you know, what's behind the curtain at Kona. And I think it's just so invaluable to weigh in on this particular race. Because I've often told people, you know, when you do a full Ironman, it definitely is a full Ironman if you're in Texas or New Zealand or Santa Rosa, wherever the case might be. But there is truly a distinction, something special and surreal about Kona.
So I can say that people never get tired of hearing Kurt talk about Kona. So I've been in some of these storytelling sessions, as I'd like to say. It equates to like little kids listening to Santa Claus read them a book. It's just, you can have these triathletes are just enraptured with whatever Kurt is saying, hanging on every word. So no one tells a Kona story like Kurt Madden.
Yeah, and I'll take this opportunity to plug this, John, on our YouTube channel right now, TriDot Triathlon Training on YouTube. Elizabeth and I sat down about a year ago with Kurt, and he just kind of, we called it the Kona experience, and Kurt just, that was when I met Kurt over the phone, and we just, he was so gracious to take the time to really walk us through what it's like to be on course and describe, you know, the energy lab and describe the winds coming off the coast as you're going up and down to Javi. And he really, I mean, Kurt's description really puts you there, right? I mean mentally. And so I would encourage folks to kind of go catch Kurt walking you through what the course is like. And we've got footage of the Kona course to kind of go along with it. And it really, especially in this year where we're not able to watch the broadcast, right? And the race isn't happening. Kind of take a chance to get your Kona fix by hearing Kurt Madden talk about it. So Kurt, when we kind of take a look back, you know, your very first crack at the Ironman World Championships, you placed 7th overall back when the race was held in Oahu. And then once the race moved to the Big Island, you placed 6th and 10th in different years in Kona. Just kind of tell us about your personal experience racing the Ironman World Championships and what did those fantastic top 10 finishes mean to you?
Yeah, that was each race was a little bit different, and I'll spend a couple of minutes on each of the races. Probably the first one, you know, again in 1980 that we were on the island of Oahu, and to try to create some context for people that you have to imagine that there was no internet. It was really just kind of word of mouth. I was very fortunate that the person that won the year before, Tom Warren, living in San Diego, approached me. So I came home and just had been married and shared it with my wife. She said, hey, let's go ahead and go for it. And entry fee was a total of $20. I sent in my entry fee, and all I did for a year was I would swim and I would bike and I would run. And it was just volume, 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 volume. I think that very first bike that I purchased, it was a Windsor. I think it must have weighed at least 40 pounds. I didn't use cycling shoes. I used some Nike waffle trainers. If you go back in the history of Nike, that's what they had. Yeah. And I'll never forget that when I got over to Oahu, went into a bike shop to make sure everything was legit, the guy said, you know what, I can make you a lot faster on the bike. And I said, what do you mean? He said, if we put these toe clips on, you're going to bike so much better. I said, I'm in, brah. go ahead and do that. That would be great. So here we have a pre-race meeting the day before. We had ABC Wide World of Sports. We had Diana Nyad. We had Jim Lampley there. That was Dave's first race. We had 99 people. The one challenge, it was going to be at Waikiki. Well, back in the day, we were kind of hardcore that no matter what, we would just plow through conditions. But they made the right call, even on that memorable day, because Waikiki, a big storm had come through and the swells were 20 feet. And I said, you know, we're going to probably lose everyone here just in the swim. So they moved it over to Alamoana Harbor, which they just set up two lane lines. It was 1,000 yards times four, kind of the honor system. And my strategy was pretty straightforward. I was very strong in the water as a kind of former lifeguard, a high school swimmer. And it was just, hey, go off the front, hang on the bike. And guy never knew about the marathon. So the swim went really well. I think I came out sixth. I got on the bike and I think I was about mile 40. And there was a gentleman back in the day named John Howard. And John was a former pro cyclist. John must have went by me at about 50 miles an hour. I think his split, if you go back and look at the split that he did on that day on a very antiquated bike, 112 miles with traffic, I think his split was 416. It's incredible. So anyway, to make a long story.
616 for mine.
No, yeah. Just finishing the bike, it was a leapfrog that you had your own crew that would follow you. And I know it was at mile 110, just around the airport. I was approaching Aloha Tower, and I got a flat. Well, I was in traffic, and my support crew wasn't with me. I didn't have a spare. So I literally rode with a flat the last 2 miles to get to Aloha Tower. When they handed me a 6x8 piece of paper, and they said, follow this map, and that's the way the marathon's going to go. Well, in Honolulu, they have one-way streets. So I was literally trying to hold the map in my hand, check the street signs. I got lost two or three times, approached a local who was inhaling some special Hawaiian herbs. And all he said is, brah, you go that way. And I just continued to run. I caught up with my crew later on, and I just kept moving up and moving up. And little did I realize at mile 18, it's like, there's Tom Warren. You know, oh my goodness, I'm going to have to pass the person that brought me into the mix. But it's battle now, we'll make up later, Tom. And I was just over the moon to come down to Capilano Park, finishing seventh overall. It was a life-changing endeavor that if I look at getting married, watching my two sons being born, that right there just changed my life. It's like, wow. But wow. We thought it was like Woodstock, and it would never happen again. Little did I realize that here I am back in 1982. Now it's on the Big Island. Now the race had grown to 1,000 people, and it was still kind of California type. But I'll never forget, again, great swim. I held back a little bit on the bike, and I came off the bike 20th and continued to move up. And a friend of mine who I had trained with extensively, he said, that's not fair. You can't pass me. And I said, what do you mean? And he says, well, I was running like 90 miles a week. And I said, well, I was only running 60, but I think we'll talk after the race. I've got to go now. And just crossing that finish line, it's like, wow, sixth in the world. That was beyond my wildest dreams. And then to go to 1983 to come back and finish in the top 10. I mean, and I think it was about respect, about camaraderie, and those visuals that I saw in those races to this day. They're still in my head. I can still see Dave Scott running down, you know, to the finish at, say, mile 21 or 22, just looking fearless, looking awesome. And again, those are just awesome memories.
So, Kurt, as you think back to those years when you were in the mix as a top-ranked pro, those years where you placed top 10 at the Big Island in Oahu, you were mixing up with the best Ironman athletes in the world. What memories do you have of those guys from that generation that you first raced against?
You know, I think looking back on that, it was a time that I truly cherish, meaning that we were young, we were wild, we were free. And living in San Diego, you can sense that that was kind of the epicenter of where the triathlon started. Dave Scott was kind of in his own world up in Davis, California, but anytime you wanted to have a good time, get super, super tired, not know what was going to happen next, and really be humbled, go for a bike ride with Scott Tinley, join in with Mark Allen, get together with the Terminator Molina, and those guys will crush you. But it was in a way, if you could just hang with them, it was just an incredible experience. I remember I went on one bike ride with Mark Allen, and I think we went about 60 miles and we finished. And he said, so what do you think? And I said, Mark, what do I think? I think, you know what? I think you're going to do fine at Kona. And I'll never forget that night I came home and my wife's like, I can't sleep with you. And I said, what do you mean you can't sleep with me? She goes, there is so much heat coming off your legs right now. I cannot stay in this bed. And I'm like, oh my gosh. So I really pushed myself hard, but I think they were good guys. They were always, it was about respect. It was about pushing the bar. It was about elevating your game. It was about being fearless. That I know those guys so intimately, and they were fearless in their own way. And I think, again, that fast forwards to our athletes today. So it was a great time. The one thing I do want to mention, too, in the early 80s, what was so different, and maybe it's hard to get your head around it right now, but when there's no money involved, it's a little bit different vibe as compared to when money came into the sport. Mm. That really changed things. It was more of a dog-eat-dog versus, hey, let's just hammer it out for 8 or 9 or 10 hours, and you know, we'll go out and have a drink of beer and eat some tacos after the race. So it was different. But to this day, in fact, in February, we had a 40-year anniversary of the class of 1980 that did this race. And Tinley was there, and Dave Scott, you know, he chimed in, you know, via Zoom, and Chuck Newman and John Howard. And it was just the camaraderie and the respect. It was something special where there was no ego. It was just like, man, we did this thing together. So it was really, really cool.
So I think it's cool to kind of hear that that camaraderie was there from day one.
And it's still there.
It's why we're still around. But just even thinking back to, you know, we're kind of on this opposite end of the spectrum here. We're working with TriDot. We're working with advanced software and analytics and big data and all these things. And you guys were out there really, there was nothing much to look back on. I mean, there was cycling and running, but there was nothing like this. There was no script to follow. And it makes sense to, yeah, we're going to be racing for 8, 10, 12 hours. So let's just go do as many miles as we can in a day. So, I mean, truly you guys were really laying the foundation of what we do today and creating those training processes. And really, there was probably a lot more error than trial involved. So we appreciate all that work that went into it. But, you know, just to go and be able to produce those results on, you know, we have the benefit now of all these years of experience and all these years of learning and research and now even lab testing and data analysis, whereas you guys were just out there kind of winging it.
And John, let me chime in on that. And you brought up some really good, you know, really good points. And I think it's important with the now generation, meaning the people that are really racing right now. And we do depend upon, you know, TriDot and analytics and technology and power meters and all those things. But when you really go back to the fundamental purest nature of the sport, or you look at it in its purest form, I think when you can use your RPE or your rate of perceived effort, and the second thing too, your racing instincts and being intuitive. And I think we can never forget about that, because we've all faced situations, me included, that I've been in a race, everything's dialed in. For some reason, my power meter's off, or my heart rate meter's off, or my coach is yelling at me to pick it up when I'm looking at him like, hey, John, I'm already like in a zone 5, John. I don't think I can go much harder. Kurt, you got to pick it up a little bit more. Okay, coach, I'll give it the best I can. So that was neat, and it was very simple back then. Even the fueling process, I'll never forget, like in 1982 on Kona, believe it or not, as I weighed in of what my rocket fuel was going to be, or what was my superstarch going to be, it was really, just to put it out there, I pre-mixed 2 bananas in one bottle with something called ERG, and that was the electrolyte replacement with glucose. And that's literally what I had, 2 different bottles for the entire 112 miles on the bike, with a little bit of water at the aid stations. And I can't remember what they had at the aid stations back in the early 80s. I think there was water and ice, and that was maybe about it. So yeah, we've come so far.
So Kurt, I think there's a perhaps urban legend of McDonald's being one of the aid stations. Is there any validity to that athletes were stopping in a McDonald's out there to get some water and hydration?
I'm not sure.
Fueled by French fries.
On the Queen Cam Highway, John, I'm still looking. I haven't found that the McDonald's out there, but I know back in 1980 on Oahu, I know it was pretty loose then, that there were some people, because there was no time limit, you can imagine. Mm-hmm. No time limit on Ironman. There was one gentleman that actually stopped into a Denny's at about 2 o'clock in the morning. So he started at 7 a.m. at 2 a.m. He stopped in and had a couple cups of coffee and pancakes, and I think he finished at 7 a.m. So that's about the closest I can get.
That's my kind of Ironman right there. Absolutely. Yep. Hey, I mean, French fries, it's just carbs and salt, right? Yeah, you can rock with that. So Kurt, any book, article, podcast, conversation about the legends of Kona has to mention Dave Scott, Mark Allen, and the Iron War of 1989. And you've kind of brought up your relationship and friendship with those guys up already. But tell us just a little bit more about the Dave and Mark rivalry and what you remember from the World Championships of 1989.
Yeah, I actually, I'm going to give you our listeners a little bit of context. I wasn't quite as involved in sport in 1989, you know, when this race took place. But I've got a pretty good foundation that I'll give you kind of the lead up to that. I needed to literally step away and be a better dad and be a better husband and, you know, be a better educator. But I think that what I can capture for our listeners is you've got to look at two different phenomenal people, meaning that genetically, both Dave and Mark, it's very evident that they've just got super genetics. At the same time, there was always this rivalry. I know back in 1982, as I tried to prep Mark for the race, I knew Mark would swim with Dave. I was very confident Mark could ride with Dave and on the run. That was still kind of a question mark. You have to keep in mind that really Dave had a little bit more experience. And Dave, as we know, he's fearless. I think that, you know, for a story that some people might not realize, but again, I remember it vividly, Dave was the master at psyching people out. And he was the person that, you know, could always play those mind games with people without doing too much or talking smack. But I'll never forget, we had the carbo loading party in 1982, and it was down at the Kona Surf, which is at the kind of the opposite end of the pier. It's about 5 or 6 miles down the road. So you can imagine you've got a single line of cars driving to the Kona Surf. It starts at 6 p.m. Dave, being very, very brilliant, as he always is, he started out on a Leahy Drive with some super small shorts, those huge bulging quads, that big chest. He starts doing fartlek workouts right on a Leahy Drive. And I can tell you, honestly, the conversation at dinner was, did you see Dave Scott? Man, he is ripped, man. He's ready to go. He's going to shred, you know, Mark Allen. He's going to do this. He's going to do that. And he would play that game. At the same time, Mark was the Zen master. Mark was the guy that's behind the scene, building his inner confidence, not putting himself out there. But that internal drive between both of them to try to be better than each other on any particular day, it was just incredible. And I know in 1982, it was very unfortunate that Mark, as I was racing, I wanted to see them running together in the marathon. Unfortunately, you know, during the bike, I'm looking around. It's like, well, where's Mark? Well, his derailleur broke out at Hobby. Mark was, he got a ride all the way back. But I think when you look at the war that did take place and you've read the book or the, you know, listen to the Audible podcast of it, or the Audible version, it's incredible of how they played these mind games and what led up to this race. But I think at the end of the game, at the end of the day, we know that the mental aspect really contributes to separating a winner and someone that might be second. Not to say the person who's second is the loser, but it's that mental game. And I think it's so nice as I watch Time Has Gone that they've come back together in such a way that they're working with Ironman, they're at events, there's some really, really great camaraderie. But I think that's way, and I think it was really more of a collaborative type competition, especially as we're older, we can look back and say, yeah, it was getting intense. Because I know Dave personally, Dave puts a lot of pressure on himself to perform at the highest level. And again, Mark is in that zen-like state of always trying to bring out the best in his game.
So, Kurt, they were both six-time world champions, and kind of as you mentioned initially, Dave Scott was the one who was kind of the heir apparent. He was winning every year, and it was up to Mark to beat him and tried forever. And we kind of had this crossover point that is known as the Iron War, where Mark had won six, and then after Iron War, which spoiler alert, Mark won. Mark went on to win six times after that. So
yeah, and I have actually read that book, Kurt, and I was just riveted. I went through that one really, really fast, and you know, the author did such a good job of kind of profiling them and kind of, you know, getting you, the reader, kind of into their psyche and into their mentality and showing kind of how they were different, you know, personalities and different approaches to the sport, but were both just top shelf champions in their own right. And on race day, you know, I think what really mesmerized people and why it's considered why that one's considered the Iron War over their other races together is the fact that they were just shoulder to shoulder the entire course. You know, Mark just stayed right on Dave's feet throughout the entire swim. They came out on the bikes, and Mark just stayed, you know, draft, you know, out of the draft zone, but right behind Dave the entire bike course. And then when they got to the run, you know, and the book really captures it well, because it kind of had the account from fellow racers saying, yeah, we saw them coming the other direction of the turnaround, and they were shoulder to shoulder that entire run course up until just the final, you know, up and down hill, and the descent down to the finish line is when Mark finally was able to break Dave and pull away. But just their proximity to each other in that particular race, I mean, we haven't seen anything like it since, right, Kurt?
No, we really haven't. You know, we might not ever see that again, but I think it's great for people to really be thoughtful and reading that, understand of what it's like just to finish an Ironman, because that's the ultimate goal for everyone. It's not whether you're on the podium or you win your age group, whatever the case might be. It's more about finishing and just trying to get your head around what it would be like, because that creates a lot of pressure. Some people just get mad if someone is kind of drafting off them for 10 or 15 seconds. They get their undergarments kind of all worked up, versus if you go side by side with someone like Dave, knowing that any second anything can. And again, you have to remember that each of them, they've got a couple surprises in their goodie bag that they're going to pull out. And Dave was always good at doing that. When do I make my move? When do I pull the trigger, knowing that there's no looking back? And Mark is the last guy you want to try to run away from. Same thing with Dave. He is just, he'll leave it on the line. I think it's very riveting to look back at the history. And I'm hoping that in the future we'll have a similar race like this, but you just never know.
So when we talk about the legends of Kona, it does go a little bit deeper than Mark, Dave, and kind of the founding champions, so to speak. And we have, at this point, over 40 years of history and stories of champions. And John, Kurt, just for both of you, because John, I know you're a little bit more well-versed in the history of Kona than I am. You've been around the sport a little bit longer. So for both of you, can you just kind of walk me and our listeners through kind of the years in the field and tell us about maybe some of the more notable champions from Kona lore? And maybe let's do this. Let's start on the women's side. You know, we camped out on Mark and Dave for a little bit there. So let's start on the women's side. And Kurt, who are just some of the professional women that belong in the conversation as we talk about the legends of Kona?
Yeah, you know, when I'm reflecting and I look back on the women's side, I've got so much respect for our women competitors, because I think triathlon is a sport that it should be open to anyone, and especially the females. And I think everyone that I think about through the years, that they were gutsy, they were gritty, they were tenacious, they put it on the line, but they really inspired other females to say, you know what, you can do this. Maybe not do it at the level that some of these people as pros did, but really inspired them to say it's really about the journey, the preparation, going to any Ironman and finishing that it is life-changing. But a couple of people that I'll touch on, I think the first one is Julie Moss. I think Julie, literally, I've known Julie since 1982, and we've done a lot together. We were both sponsored by Nike. We were able to travel the world as pros. We're still friends today. She was at the big 40th annual reunion earlier this year. And Julie was someone that was really at the right place at the right time, that when you look at what she did, that she was literally underprepared, she was over her head, and that dramatic finish at the same time. I think Triathlete had an article about this recently, and as I've weighed in with a lot of people behind the scenes, that they were going to really pull any television live cast of, not live, but production of Kona, until literally the very end, when Julie really had some major issues coming down Alihi Drive. And I think that dramatic moment, that it was a turning point for our sport, it really put the world on fire. That, wow, how incredible is this young little gal from California able to finish crawling on her hands and knees? Kathleen McCartney, that I know personally, her just kind of literally going by, and just that energy and that empathy that people had to say, you've got this, Julie, you cannot quit, just crawl. And it was life-changing. And I know that Julie, she will take that to her grave, what she did. And I raced with Julie a couple of years ago on Oceanside 70.3, and she was really getting ready for Texas. And I was like, wow, Julie was in her 50s, and she was fearless at Oceanside. And that's not an easy course. She was, I think her run split that day for a 13.1 or half marathon, I think she ran around 145 or 150, somewhere around there. Wow. So just impressed. And Julie and I go way back. So again, it's that respect. Next person, Paula Newby Fraser. Again, very similar to a female version of Dave Scott or Mark Allen. The very soft-spoken, very quiet, but on race day, no doubt, she could compete with the best of the best. And I know Paula, and I see her at races all the time now, and really soft-spoken. Again, best friend is Paul Huddle, who works for Ironman, but Paula really set the bar and set the tone. I think the other person that I would just talk about would just be Daniela Ryf and even Rinne. I think the thing that you want to remember about these females, the one thing I look at when I look at the very, very top echelon, you've got to look in their eyes on race day. And when you see that winner, that fiery, you know, instinct coming out and radiating, there's no doubt. But I've seen Daniela at her best. I've seen her possibly at her worst. Same thing with Rinne, I think a few years ago when she ran the fastest split in Kona on that day. I think she had the fifth fastest time amongst men and women. And we know now that as you look at videotapes and we're trying to improve our athletes with running form and efficiency, Rinne is your go-to. So job well done for all of them, and they all just raised the bar.
Yeah, I think especially with Paula Newby Fraser being the queen of Kona, and we always pay homage to Mark and Dave, the 6-time world champions, but she won 8 times. So you know, that's, you know, taking what they did and kind of hang on, fellas, you know, y'all got 6, I got 8, and you know, she's running out of fingers to put those rings on. So yeah, just a fantastic job there. And for me, another one that was just a tremendous amount of respect for was Chrissy Wellington, who kind of came out of seemingly nowhere, didn't really have the sport athletic background, and kind of had this what we might refer to as a short career, but she went undefeated. I believe it was 13 for 13, and never lost an Ironman race, including several times the Ironman World Championship. So she kind of pulled the Seinfeld, went out on top, and never lost a race. Any Ironman race she ever entered, she won it. So I think that's just an incredible feat.
Mm-hmm. On the men's side, you know, Kurt, you already mentioned some of the guys you race against personally, and we've talked about Mark and Dave, but who are maybe some of the other legends from the pro men's field?
Yeah, I'll touch on a few. I think I need to really go back and talk a little bit about Scott Tinley, or we call him ST. Scott was, you know, your typical California lifeguard, you know, nice and tan, blonde hair, big mustache. Scott wasn't the greatest swimmer. However, when Scott was on a bike and on the run, he would just hunt you down like a dog. And I think Scott was a person that was always kind of a maverick, but I've got a great deal of respect for ST because he really raised the bar. He thought outside the box. He had several wins throughout the world in his career. And I think if we look at, again, the big four, that ST was definitely a person that should get a lot of respect. And the one thing about ST is he was your practical joker. He was the guy that I can remember, I think it was in 82, I was just about ready. I was walking down the steps and you know, in Kona, and he says, "Hey, Kurt, you got a second?" I said, "Yeah, ST, what's up, man?" He says, "Well, here's the deal." He says, "You feeling pretty good?" I says, "Yeah, I'm doing well. How about you?" And he goes, "Yeah, I'm fine." He goes, "You know, I didn't want to tell you this, but I probably should. I just went by your bike, and you got a flat tire." I'm like, "Okay, Scott, you rascal, you." So guess what I thought all about the swim? All I thought about the swim was not my swim, but he could throw you off your game very quickly.
Was he joking, or was he not joking?
But he was the guy on a baseball team or a football team that would be someone that would keep everybody loose. But you know what? He had your back. And knowing ST, that he always was going to be there for you. Great guy, ambassador of the sport. So I wanted to touch on him. And then I think if I fast forward up to now, you know, Jan Frodeno, you know, what can we say about Jan? I've got so much respect for him and what he's done. I've seen him at his worst. And again, I've seen him at his best. I never will forget a few years ago when he had that injury. He was walking down Alihi Drive, and it's like, oh, no, that can't be Jan Frodeno. Conversely, last year, he was killing it. He had the perfect race. But I know the work he does behind the scene. He's very soft-spoken, but on game day, he is a tiger. You do not want to mess with him. And I think he's really pushed the Germans to raise the bar. So, again, I could talk all day about these great guys, but I'll leave it at that.
I follow Jan on social media. He's a really good Instagram follow, and I'm always so jealous of just his training pictures because he's got his bike on the trainer, you know, out on his back patio. He's got a nice little lap lane in his backyard, and he's just this beautiful view of wherever it is that he lives. And so he just has such a great setup. But John, for you, who are some of the men that have really captivated your attention over the years?
So I think a lot of it is, and this is probably true for a lot of folks, when they are racing their first Ironman, you pay special attention and perhaps watch the coverage over and over. And it's our best opportunity to kind of relive and see what the Ironman race is like. So for me, I kind of came up in the, there was an Australian phase where primarily it was Craig Alexander and Chris McCormick. And those guys are just fantastic athletes. And, you know, really, I think Kurt would probably agree that they're very reminiscent of the Mark and Dave of maybe a decade prior, where those guys were always at each other. They were countrymen. And they were always trying to outdo one another. Perhaps one of my favorite races was the 2009 World Championship. And a guy I knew and admired, Chris Lieto, was doing what he does, which he was a phenomenal cyclist. He'd always ride away. And then his strategy was to hold on for as long as possible on the run. And Craig would go on to win. But Chris led that race through, gosh, I don't know if it was like mile 24, mile 25. I believe it was actually, they were shoulder to shoulder later than Mark and Dave in the Iron War. Now they didn't do the whole race together.
Yeah.
Lieto held that first position for so long. And it wasn't until like that. And so even now, if I ever rewatch that race, I feel like, I hope that something's going to change and I will Lieto to keep going, but inevitably
maybe this year he'll get it.
Yeah. Every time Alexander passes him. But, that was just a great era of racing with some great guys.
So I've heard it said that folks rarely come out of nowhere, you know, to win the Ironman World Championships. And typically, the athletes that win on the Big Island, they've either podiumed or come really close to it in years prior. But not every athlete that podiums in Kona, you know, goes on to eventually win the race. So Kurt, when we talk about these legends of our sport and we talk about, you know, the folks that have won in Hawaii, and there's even a ton that we didn't mention that were able to get a world championship or two on their resume. You know, what is it that kind of sets these legends and these champions apart from the peers of their era that maybe came close to a win but just never quite made that final step?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is really, I think, a really pertinent question here. You've got to think of Kona as your Everest, that you're going to get into that death zone. And you can describe it to people, you can watch videos, you can read books, but I can tell you honestly, you've got to pay your dues. You've got to go out there. You've got to experience Pele. You've got to experience the wind, the humidity, the heat, the conditions. Really get to know that entire swim course from start to finish repeatedly, not once or twice. But you've got to really know every little detail of that swim. You've got to know that first transition very well of all the chaos and everything you go to. You've got to know the bike inside and out, every mile, knowing the conditions are never the same. It literally changes by the hour with no heads up. You've got to know what it's like to get up to Javi. You've got to understand that turnaround. You've got to know what it's like to come back and go by, you know, Waikoloa, knowing that you're jumping into that furnace that typically the last 30 miles is a headwind. You're exhausted. You're looking at your power. You're just getting, you know, grind it into the lava, and then get off that bike at 1 o'clock in the afternoon going, oh my goodness, I've got a full marathon to go. And I think the people that separates, meaning the people that finish at the very top as compared to other people, there's a couple factors. I think they go in with a real open mindset. They have a lot of inner confidence. They've got grit. They follow their race plan. They follow their nutrition. They can adapt and pivot on the fly. They've got good instincts that you have to develop in Kona. And I think you don't get that experience until you race Kona. It's incredible through the years. I've heard so many people say, I'm going to go to Kona and I'm going to do X, Y, and Z. And I ask the question very nicely, well, how many times have you done Kona? This is my first time. Okay, well, let's kind of set the bar a little bit low. Let's maybe just finish it. And don't put too much pressure on yourself and gain that experience. And I think the people that have done well there, the people we've talked about today, if you really drill down and talk about that common denominators, those are things that I've just shared. And it's just incredible that Kona will humble any person at all. I don't care if they're a pro, an age grouper, you name it, and it will. I've seen it time and time again, even myself. I've hit some real dark spots along the way. But I think it's also, it keeps you so humble that you want to go back and do it a little bit better the next time. So I think, again, if we look at the max VO2 with our top 10 people, men, female, they're going to be close. What separates it? Grit, tenacity, mental toughness, following their race plan and their nutrition.
So the athletes who have become legends in Kona, they couldn't have done so without just the amount of festivities and just the massive production hype train side of the Kona Race Week. And as a media guy, it is just really, really cool to see how the storytellers of Kona have become just as much a part of the Kona lore as the athletes whose stories they are telling. And perhaps one of the most well-known Kona storytellers and personalities is a good friend of yours, Kurt, Bob Babbitt. Tell us about kind of Bob's role in the Kona festivities and how it's evolved over time and what makes him a legend of Kona.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think, so I met Bob in 1980. I met him actually a day or two before the Ironman in 1980, and we were actually on a bus ride together. They rented a bus, and they took us around the entire island of Oahu just to check out the course, and we were just sitting next to each other, and we kind of hit it off. And he lives in San Diego. We've been friends ever since. But I think in the very beginning, Bob did not create the storyline of where he was going to be today. I think it just evolved over time. Bob is a person that is very unselfish. Bob gives and gives and gives and gives, and he loves the sport. He's probably the best example with challenge athletes, with doing interviews. Bob is a guy that can somehow find a way to get to a race and another race and another race and another race and another race. But he's easy to talk to. He's very skilled at what he does do, but he engages you to really drill down to find out a little bit behind the scenes of what's happened. And I think Bob has developed that reputation that he was never on the podium at Kona, but you know what? We don't need everyone, you know, to be on the podium. We need people that can really connect the dots. And I think Bob is so well respected. And I feel real good about Bob because he's just flat out a good guy. And I remember last year at the Ultraman World Championship, just after day one, it was day two, and we were up at Volcano at about 5,000 feet in elevation. I had a jacket on and gloves, and he looked at me and he says, "Kurt, you're shivering." I said, "Yeah, I'll be okay once I start." He goes, "Oh, no." He took the jacket right off his back and gave it to me and said, "You know what, brah? You're going to wear this. We'll connect later on." I'm thinking, that's class. That's a guy that takes the jacket off his back, but that's the way. And it's not about Bob. It's about really promoting the sport, about inspiring you, about working with people that really have encountered some great difficulties. So Bob is a kick. If you're with Bob, you're always going to have a good time.
And he's done such amazing work with his foundation, through Challenge Athletes Foundation. And, really equipping folks to be able to participate not only in triathlon but basically every sport that's out there, and just done a tremendous amount of good for so many people. So yeah, definitely a huge asset and contributor to the sport. So Kurt, you are an Ironman finish line call from the one and only Mike Riley has become synonymous with the event and the brand and really our sport. And clearly sets Mike in his rightful place as a Kona legend. Tell us, Kurt, having your friend Mike call you across that finish line time and time again, what does that mean for you?
Yeah, it's sometimes we tend to forget about certain people, that Mike's not the athlete out there doing the training and the preparation, but you know what? Mike is very cerebral. Mike knows his part. He knows his part in the production. Mike studies and studies and studies and studies, and he really makes sure that on race day, he's on his game, that I could not even imagine doing his job, that to speak and stay engaged and take very few breaks for 17, 18 hours. When I'm done with my race, I like to either get warm or get together with a few friends and just unwind. And I've seen Mike do that. And I think, again, it's just incredible the reputation, you know, that Mike has developed through the years. And there's just something about every race I've been at. And Mike, every race he's at, he somehow, if he's taking a break or something, but I can just hear his voice vividly, he's able to hit the hit the real quick talking points about each athlete. Boom, boom, boom. And he would say it for me when I come in. He never misses me. So I think people ask me, what's the most favorite part of the Ironman? And I always say it's the last 20 yards because I know Mike's going to be there. And I know that recently a close friend of mine in San Diego that actually had done an Ironman, his name is Jeff Lipscomb, that he had a chronic long-term terminal illness. And it was really incredible how you can imagine someone is literally dying in their own home. Babbitt works behind the scenes to get Riley to go over there. And this guy is literally on his deathbed. And Mike Riley comes up and says, you are an Ironman. I mean, it doesn't get any better than that.
Yeah. Kurt read Mike's book that he put out,
mm-hmm.
the Voice of Iron Man, and he just his memoir of sorts, really, of just him recounting over the years. And what struck me from that book is he's telling really good stories, and he's telling other people's stories about, you know, their own Iron Man day and what their background was and why their finish was a momentous finish to Mike. Because basically the whole book is Mike saying, hey, here's over my years of making finish line calls, here's some of the athletes that have stood out to me, but you really see his heart in the sense that every athlete matters to Mike mm-hmm. Riley. Everybody's story matters to Mike Riley, and he really sees himself as taking, you know, his name takes a back seat in that moment, and he just wants to exalt the name of the athlete crossing the finish line, and just the way he will call, you know, he'll visit hospital rooms, like you said, he'll call up athletes, you know, who's finish line he might have missed or whose race that maybe he wasn't at, and just he so selflessly will do everything he can to exalt the name of another athlete and their story, and it's just incredible to me to see that from him.
I'll say the greatest place on earth is the Ironman finish line, and specifically in perhaps that last hour, and especially back in the day when there was the 7 o'clock mass start, so you knew that every athlete had to cross that finish line by straight up midnight. And the energy that Mike had in those last mm-hmm. 20 minutes was crazy. Mm-hmm. And you know, he was on the beach at 6-7 o'clock in the morning to start the race. Yeah. And he'd been out there throughout the day. So he's been out there as long as the longest
and
athlete.
And he's been talking all day long.
All day long, but yet mm-hmm. that doesn't slow him down. He's out there dancing in the finish chute. He's got his towel that he's, and he's keeping that crowd so engaged. And I can only imagine the energy that those athletes get and just the will to finish, and he's calling them in, and you can hear the voice for, it's got to be a half mile away, and just the energy that he creates from everyone that's there. There's nothing like the finish line of an Ironman in those last couple minutes, and as he's counting down, and just again goosebumps just even thinking about it. But yeah, I've even been on the end of some of those things that he's gone above and beyond to deliver those special messages. I've handed him my phone before, and he's declared people an Ironman over the phone.
Yeah.
Kind of same thing, whether he was not at that race or on a break or something. And we had a lady that was wanting to finish an Ironman before her father passed away. And unfortunately we missed by like a week. But Mike kind of did that same thing, recorded a message for mm-hmm. her. And when she crossed the finish line, there it was. And she was able to hear Mike Riley declare her an Ironman, even though she was just in her own neighborhood.
Yeah.
Which was really special. Yeah.
Yep. He's a legend, John. He's a legend.
Well deserved.
So whether it's fair to the athletes or not, you know, there's kind of this desire within sports fans, you know, and sports media to compare, you know, the legends of old with the champions of the now. You know, who is greater between, who's the GOAT between LeBron James and Michael Jordan? You know, how many yards would a Dan Marino or Steve Young pass for in today's NFL? You know, could the Mia Hamm USA Women's National Soccer Team beat the Alex Morgan USA Women's National Soccer Team? You know, Kurt, when you look at the Kona legends of old, many of whom we've talked about today, you know, and kind of the champions of today, you know, and you've mentioned Jan Frodeno, you've mentioned Daniela Ryf, there's Patrick Langa, Sebastian Kienle, Lucy Charles, you know, what similarities and differences do you see between these two eras? And is it even possible to try to compare these two different generations in our sport?
Yeah, that's... As I look at this question, I think probably the best visual for people that have been to Kona on race week is that it's really how they stage everything, a production. You know, it's like the World Series. And what they do on the wall right there by the small beach, by the pier, is they really have every single champion from 1978 all the way up through now. And I think as you walk down that walkway of legends and you look at every single thing, what I would say is that as we compare maybe the past to the present, the common things that I see as a person that has been in the sport for many years and still a student at heart, I mean, it's learning all the time. I think it's something that first of all, they're really good people. And I will say that humbly. It's not just about them. It's about them racing against the course. And that's the beauty. That's the beauty of what we do. And it's just really trying to complete the course. I think the other thing is that they've got grit. They've got tenacity. They've got character. They want to give back. They want to help other people, inspire other people. And each one has their own story. I think the difference of today that we know now, like John has touched on earlier, is that we've got so much technology. I know me as an athlete and a coach with Tri-Dot for about 4 years now, is that my world has changed because of the training. Back in the day in 1980s, I would just tell people, hey, this is what you have to do. Just swim, bike, and run. Just do that every single day and take recovery whenever you can. So it's really, really changed. But I think, again, it's a good, I would call it more of a continuum. There are a lot of similarities. But at the end of the day, I think people always do the best they can with what they're given on that day at that point in our sport. And you think about it, over the past 40 or so years, that we really know a lot more today. And I think our job is to share this information to make sure we're preparing people for a lifelong dream to not only be an Ironman, but it's lifetime fitness. And I think that's the beauty of what we do.
So kind of along that same line, Kurt, we've talked about from the very beginning of the Ironman World Championship, where you were there very early on. You're still competing as an athlete in the Ironman World Championships every year. So perhaps
you're still ranked number one in your age group at the All World Athlete rankings each year. But we have to say that, John.
So I think perhaps you have a unique perspective of based on all of this. Where do you see things going in the front? Something I see is that it seems like there's always a torch being passed. There's that one person who comes up and they seem to kind of temporarily possess that torch and then they hand it off willingly or unwillingly or maybe it's more someone comes and takes that torch. But where do you see the Ironman World Championships going? What do you see from this next generation?
Yeah, you know, this year with COVID-19, it's really been, again, a very humbling experience that I think in our wildest dreams, we never thought this would happen, that we've had to pivot and adapt and, you know, delay that gratification to be, you know, in races and having Mike Riley say, hey, you're an Ironman. But I think as I look out on, you know, as I look at the crystal ball or my tea leaves or tarot cards or whatever you want to call it, I think it's going to be a generation of continuous improvement. I think the things that we're going to see is we're going to see many more athletes from all parts of the world getting into the mix. I think that our training is going to be refined, especially with a program like Tri-Dot to give a shout out, because I know there's no doubt in my mind that I was fortunate last year as a Tri-Dot coach is to have three of my people that qualified for Kona. Each one ended on the podium.
Wow, so, that's amazing. Yeah.
As a coach, I was so goosebump, like John, to use your term, just being able to race. And I saw all three of them out on the course going, guys, you got this. Just stay with the plan and we're going to do it together. So, and I think because we've got a plethora of information and it is really more scientific now versus it was a guessing game. So I think we're going to have more people. We're going to have fewer injuries. Our nutrition is going to improve. I think our pacing is going to improve. I think the mental game is something that is a little bit untapped. We spend so much time on the physiology, but I know if I can get into an athlete's head and get into their hearts, just like John has with me as my coach, it's really going to up my game. And I think that's really an untapped part of what we do moving forward. I think the other thing, there's no secret. I think as we look at the evolution of the sport and look at what were common characteristics in the beginning and the 90s and up to now, we are going to see more people running better off the bike. And like we say that we bike for show, we run for dough. But I think, again, if people want to enjoy the sport and finish strong, that you've got to continue to work on your running. And I know that as I look at the training that I use and the training for my athletes, it's really designed that way. But it's really about getting into something that you thought you could never do, about telling your story and know how it will transform your life. I think every person that's ever done an Ironman anywhere, they if you ask them the question, how has this changed your life? There's no doubt that they're going to say, hey, I've got more self-confidence. I don't give up. I'm tenacious. I'm forgiving. I can adapt. I can pivot. And at the end of the day, especially this year, you know what? That's exactly what we need.
Great set, everyone. Let's cool down.
Many athletes have the Kona Ironman as the race at the tip top of their bucket list. And Kurt, for those that do want to race Kona, you know, maybe they've already qualified, or maybe they're waiting for next year to try to qualify, or maybe they're training hard to get fast enough to qualify, or maybe they're just dreaming and tossing their name in the lottery each year. You know, regardless of how they get there, you know, what are maybe your couple quick top tips for someone who's looking to train to take on the Kona course?
Yeah, I think there's a couple things that you want to keep in mind. I think the main thing is that you definitely want to go slow. So you don't want to contact somebody to say, hey, I want to I want to go to Kona in 6 or 8 weeks for this season. It might take 2 or 3 or 4 years. And I think the other thing too is it's going to delay that gratification. So that's the first thing. Be patient. It's definitely a lifestyle. The second thing is that you really want to think about is, if at all possible, once we can again get out of COVID, I would highly recommend, even if it was a family vacation, go to Kona your very self. Get familiar with the swim, get familiar with the bike, get familiar with the run. I've always told people, even if you don't qualify for Kona, you can still do Kona. If you can get over there safely and train and prepare, you can actually do the swim, you can do the bike, and you can do the marathon. And I think that's really, really key. The other variable that I think is so, so essential, and we preach and teach this all the time, is don't get caught up in the hoopla, say on race week, that so many people, their heads are just spinning and they're just taking their minds way away from what they can do. And I think that's important. The other variable is heat training. There is no second guessing that you've got to be able to adapt to heat. If you're not a good person that really can handle heat, Kona might not be your race, because again, I have seen everything that you could possibly imagine with heat and heat stroke and heat exhaustion. So I think that's key. The other thing is, if you're not a good open water swimmer, I will honestly tell you that Kona is a very challenging swim course because of the ocean. I've done the course many times in training. I've done it in racing and the Ultraman. We swim 6.2 miles from point to point, so I know that area very well.
Lord.
you have to also stay with your strength training. I think open water swimming, especially in Kona, the first thing that you're going to experience is a lot of tension on your deltoids or your shoulders. So don't underestimate the swimming. If you need to get someone to work on your stroke mechanics, that's key. I think on the bike, what you want to remember is biking 112 miles on that course. It's very similar to biking about 150 miles on any other course because of the wind and the heat and, you know, the humidity and things like that. And then in the marathon, the most important thing in Kona is literally just keep running. You've got to stay in the game no matter what. You've got to go fall back on your training. You've got to listen to yourself, leverage those aid stations and things like that. So I think if I had to do that, those tips, hopefully those are helpful. But again, Kona is a very, very special place. We talk about Pele. We talk about being humbled. And just remember, always have a lot of respect for that course, that anything can and will happen. The most important thing, though, is if you can master Kona with proficiency, in my mind, you're on the podium in my book. Because I talk to so many people after the race, and the first thing they say is, man, I bombed. Tell me more. Why? I don't know. I lost it out there mentally, or I didn't follow my pacing, or my nutrition was off, or I had a nagging injury or something like that. So anyway, play the long game.
Well, that's it for today, folks. I want to thank the legendary Kurt Madden for reflecting on the legends of Kona with John and myself today. Shout out to Garmin for partnering with us on today's episode. Head to Garmin.com to see what Garmin Tri-Tech should be your next upgrade. Enjoying the podcast? Have any triathlon questions or topics you want to hear us talk about? Head to triathlon.com/podcast and click on Submit Feedback to let us know what you're thinking. We'll have a new show coming your way soon. Until then, happy training.
Thanks for joining us. Make sure to subscribe and share the Tri-Dot podcast with your triathlon crew. For more great Tri content and community, connect with us on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram. Ready to optimize your training? Head to tridot.com and start your free trial today. Tri-Dot, the obvious and automatic choice for triathlon training.